Howdy, I'm Gail King. Welcome to CBS Mornings On The Go. Ahead on this Thursday, September 10th, take us with you because we want to go with you. An update on a CBS News investigation into Iran's deadly strike on a U.S. base in Kuwait happened back in March. We'll talk with the family of one of the U.S. soldiers killed in that attack. They are still looking for answers from the Army about exactly what happened. Then a very alarming warning from a former tech worker who says AI companies are out of control and, listen to this, gambling with our lives. That's not good. We'll take a look at just how worried we should be. Plus, our exclusive conversation with Dolly Parton's sister, that would be Stella. It's a very revealing interview, you could say. It's her first since the country icon died. And wait, we've got more. Adriana Diaz sits down with two of the stars from Practical Magic 2. That would be Oscar winner Sandra Bullock and Lee Pace. They're talking about this highly anticipated sequel nearly 30 years after the original. And word on the street, it's quite good. That and more just ahead.
Oh, we have a great hour coming up.
With a friend at the table already.
With a friend
at
the table.
You're ready to go, Nate.
You know what? Well, let's jump right into these waters and talk about AI. And we begin with a dire warning from an AI insider. A former Anthropic researcher, Jacob Coxon, says the people building AI earnestly believe that it could kill us all by the end of the decade. Highly concerning, to say the least. We've been talking about it. So how worried should we be? That's the question. Joining us now to discuss is Nicholas Thompson, CEO of The Atlantic and host of the podcast The Most Interesting Thing in AI. Welcome. Good to see you. All right, so we're familiar with what Jacob had to say, but I want to read a tweet by an employee at Anthropic right now. Yeah. Jacob is correct. We really do earnestly believe that AI could kill all humans. And he said, I personally think that is 10% within the next decade. And here's where it gets interesting. I believe Anthropic is trying its best, but we do not yet have a plan to solve alignment for superintelligence and are not clearly on track to.
And he used his name.
That is very, very concerning. To me, it sounds like we're managing these small tremors, but we don't have a plan for when the big earthquake hits.
Yeah, I think what the folks at Anthropic and many other the AI companies do earnestly believe that we are heading to a point where AI could be extremely dangerous, possibly to the point of wiping out humanity. We can get into the mechanisms. They believe that they're not on pace to solve it, and they believe that there are game theory problems that are leading all the AI companies to work towards this point in a dangerous way.
Now, why is it all happening now, though, Nick?
Yeah.
Well, they've been concerned about this forever, and they've been saying this forever. The reason it's coming out right now are two. One, the OpenAI Hugging Face hack, which showed that agents can go rogue, which is part of the mechanism for things going really badly. And two, the rate at which the models are improving. And they're getting very close to this point called recursive self-improvement, where one model improves the next model, which improves the next model, which improves the next model. And the fear is humans losing control. So once you get to recursive self-improvement, that's the risk.
I hear people sounding the alarm, but is anybody doing anything to pay attention to sounding the alarm? Now what?
Well, yes, there are a number of organizations out there that are trying to say, wait a second, if you build super powerful AI, how can you make it aligned with humans? How can we as an outside organization do it? There are people at the big AI companies that are working on this, and there are people in government who are trying to think, what is the right thing that government can do? Now, there's not enough folks doing this at each of those different levels.
So you don't believe this is alarmist?
I don't believe it's alarmist. No, this is genuine. This is not some kind of op or thing.
Yeah.
These people really think this.
Yes.
I don't think, I'm not as concerned. I think AI is scary. I don't think it's that scary.
Right. You're not concerned. Are you concerned about human extinction?
I don't understand the mechanism for human extinction. So what they're specifically worried about is that AI could create a new pathogen, like a COVID times 10, right? Or that AI could create some kind of weapon or set off a nuclear launch code, or that AI would become so smart through this process that we're kind of, the humans are like mice in cages.
Right.
How far away is that?
Their belief is that it's like a couple years away. My belief is it's quite a bit further.
Now, when it comes to recursive self-improvement, it seems like that is outpacing our ability to control it. Okay, sounds easy enough to understand. Now, let me ask a question. It may seem simple by nature, and forgive me for that. Is there some type of kill switch if this thing slips out of control and it is entrenched in all of our systems that we use on a daily basis?
No, there's no kill switch. Because there are so many companies that are doing it, because the technology is so diffuse, and in fact, because agents are out in the world. Now,
agents are out in the world.
What you could have and what you should have is some kind of government organization that is setting up sort of good guy AI to monitor this all and has set up incentives for the companies to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. But then we got to trust that government organization. Yeah.
Nick Enjoy Thompson, your thanks. Life, everybody. Enjoy each day.
Hug the people you love.
Thank you, Nick. We appreciate you, man.
To changes is right. Apple holds a big event every year to roll out its newest innovations. This year, though, you could say it played a little bit of catch up, revealing the first ever foldable iPhone. So Samsung, Google, and Motorola, we know this, have had those folding phones for years. Wednesday's event also featured Apple's new CEO for the first time in his new role. Jolene Kent was there.
After months of anticipation, Apple finally unveiled its first foldable phone.
This is iPhone Duo.
Newly minted CEO John Ternus rolled it out in his first major event since taking over for Steve Jobs' successor, Tim Cook, earlier this month. Apple's head of worldwide iPhone and watch marketing, Kaiann Drance.
What was it like to unveil that today?
Oh, it was incredibly exciting and rewarding to be able to finally introduce it out into the world.
On the packed showroom floor, it was our turn to try it out.
What's really interesting is you open it up like a book, and there is no crease down the middle. It's super thin. It feels kind of like a mini iPad. One of the most useful functions, perhaps, is you lock it, fold it, stand it down like this, and suddenly it's an alarm clock.
The iPhone Duo comes with a hefty price tag, starting at nearly $2,000, and it enters a crowded field of passport-style foldables, including Samsung's Galaxy Z Fold 8 and Google's Pixel 11 Pro Fold, all similarly priced.
Why make a foldable phone right now?
Part of it is because they've been studying the market, learn what works, learn what doesn't.
It's coming out in October. Right. What does that date tell you about the supply chain?
Something like this is really hard to manufacture. It's very complex. Wow. So they want to make sure that they have enough supply to keep up with that demand.
Foldables still make up less than 5% of the overall smartphone market, but with Apple now in the fold, the question is whether the category can finally go mainstream. For CBS Mornings, I'm Jolene Kent in Cupertino, California.
I am a tech geek. I'm not going to lie to you.
You're getting it?
I'm going to get one.
You are?
I'm going to get one. I got to be honest.
I'd like to try it.
I'm curious to see it.
Yeah.
This old
reliable?
This old reliable does.
It's got to be able to fit in your pocket or your purse.
That is true. It says it's
but
very thin.
But I am curious.
I want to see it in hand first before I make that decision.
Time for a look at the stories we like to say caught our eye. Doing the honors on this Thursday is the lovely Kelly O'Grady. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning to you, Gail. All right, we're going to begin with news of more trouble around the jumbo jet donated by Qatar that's serving as the new Air Force One. So on Wednesday, President Trump's flight to Texas was delayed after the plane's emergency slide deployed while on the tarmac. Sources tell CBS News it happened after one of the jet's crew members accidentally triggered the inflatable slide. President Trump was not on board when the incident happened. He later told reporters they were doing a check on the slide and wanted to make sure everything works perfectly. Later took off without any more issues. And we've got some wild video from Atlanta after a car crash left a vehicle and its driver dangling from an overpass. I want you to take a look at this. So you can see the driver's legs hanging out of the passenger side of the car. An incident report says the driver told police he lost control, flipped over a rail, and off the bridge. The driver was taken to the hospital and get this, thank goodness, escaped without any major injuries.
Yeah.
That's what you call lucky. Mm-hmm. And 25 years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks led to tighter security at airports, a major change could be on the way. Senior administration officials tell CBS the TSA is considering allowing travelers to bring water bottles through security. It would only apply to TSA PreCheck members at select airports equipped with newer screening technology. And it comes just days after another announcement from the agency. Remember, we told you the TSA said it would allow PreCheck members without tickets to access areas past checkpoints, including gates. And finally, Coco Gauff headed to the semifinals at the U.S. Open. That was a close one. She fought off a couple match points in a tiebreaker to defeat Mira Andreeva in the quarterfinals Wednesday. It marks her 90th win at a major tournament. Tonight, she'll face Elena Rybakina, who just became the world's top-ranked women's player after her own quarterfinal win yesterday. Gauff said in an interview that it's going to be a tough match, She won her first Grand Slam at the U.S. Open back in 2023. Guys, that money's on Coco.
Oh,
that is going to be such a good match. But Coco seems really like on. They're all on a mission.
And of course, Gail turns to me. She goes, tonight.
Tonight.
And I know I'm reading her. I know it's tonight. Should we go? Should we go? Can we go?
But it's also Ella Langley tonight, and I want to see her. So it's hard.
Coco's locked in right now.
Yeah, and we're going to see Coco later. But I like what you said about allowing water bottles through, because I had to throw two water bottles away the other day that are unopened, the little bitty ones. So I'm glad about this.
Oh, life is rough.
Yes, because I paid for them, Nate.
You were so thirsty.
Yes, I was. I was. And I paid for them, and they were unopened.
Okay.
And then they say, do you want to go out and drink it? No, I don't.
I'm not thirsty right now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It is important to hydrate.
There
Kelly,
you go.
Thank you. Now we have
Nora.
Yes. Now we have an update on our CBS News investigation into Iran's deadly attack on a U.S. base in Kuwait back in March. The strike killed six U.S. troops and wounded dozens. This morning, the parents of one of those killed are speaking out for the first time. They want the Army to explain what happened and what's being done to prevent a similar attack. Jonah Kaplan has the story.
It's been just about 6 months since the attack. Why speak now?
We always want to get his name out. But there's more.
His name was Cody Cork, 35 years old, engaged to be married, and deployed for a sixth time overseas. The Florida native arrived in Kuwait last September with the 103rd Sustainment Command. Cody's father, Jim, and stepmother, Stacy, sharing with us this photo Cody sent just hours before he was killed in an Iranian drone strike in the early days of Operation Epic Fury.
It's almost as if he knew, I'm not supposed to be here. This is going to end badly. That is exactly what those eyes are saying.
Cork was one of six U.S. service members killed in the attack, the deadliest of the conflict. Multiple sources told CBS News Army intelligence warned as early as January Iran would attack the remote post at a Kuwaiti port.
It never crosses your mind that your son's in danger in Kuwait on a logistics detail.
The Corks, for the first time, sharing that their son, as one of the assigned force protection officers, delivered repeated warnings to the unit's leader, Brigadier General Clint Barnes.
I was told by some senior officers in that command that he had put it up to the general. This base is a target base. It is not where we need to be.
Corks's reported warnings are the latest in a string of alleged failures uncovered by our months-long CBS News investigation. Soldiers say the Army also disregarded concerns about thin aerial defenses and ignored requests for medical supplies.
This is the formal uniform, but did he ever get to wear this?
Not that one.
Not informal, no.
Those grieving for the fallen have been told an Army investigation into what happened is finished, but not released. The Corks told us they want and need answers. In a statement to CBS News, an Army spokesperson said, the U.S. Army is committed to transparency and respecting the privacy of our Gold Star families. We ask for patience as we prioritize support to our soldiers' families during this sensitive time.
Oh, sweet pea. The whole intent behind all of this is to find that period at the end of the sentence, that piece that we can say, we made his sacrifice worth it.
For Jim and Stacy Cork, their home is filled with reminders of Cody's service. A marker at Florida National Cemetery is where they come to think about his sacrifice.
We can speak for our son. No, he can't do it, but we can.
General Barnes did not respond to our request for comment, but the Army has told us the investigation is done, it's complete, and it's in the process of scheduling briefings with each individual family. We're in touch with many of those families, and they've said they've not heard from the Army and no dates have been set.
That's why these stories are so important, Jonah. Just a simple thing of the mother saying to her son, Sweet Pea. Mm. We can all relate to that. You all have nicknames for your children.
And thank you, Jonah, for continuing this tough reporting on the Pentagon's actions and the way soldiers are treated and their families. Yes. This is so incredibly important. The strength of a nation is how they treat their veterans.
Well, and just like with this 9/11 commemoration, there's no expiration date for grief.
Exactly.
This doesn't
right.
go away. It's not a 25th anniversary.
Exactly.
It's a one-year commemoration 25 times.
Yeah.
So 6 months. Now they do it 1 month, six times. This is something they're going to deal with forever.
Yeah, you're right about that. It's perfectly put. Jonah, thank you. Coming up, Gail's exclusive interview with Dolly Parton's sister Stella.
Dolly Parton fans, talking to you. We are all still mourning the death of the great Dolly Parton. We knew her as a country music legend, a businesswoman, a philanthropist, and a visionary, and just so much fun. But to Stella Parton, she was simply her big sister. Stella says she spoke with her sister on the phone every Tuesday morning over coffee. She said, we used to have those good coffee clatches. In an exclusive interview, we caught up with Dolly's little sister. She's 3 years younger than Dolly, to reflect on the superstar's legacy. We met her in Nashville at the historic RCA studio, where Dolly recorded some of her most memorable songs.
I felt like she always belonged to the world because I was 7 years old when she first started, when she was 10. And it's like she was like a bird that just flew off.
Flitting all around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really enjoy my life. I enjoy people, and I just am happy to get to make a living in what I love to do.
As we sit here today, you know, I wonder if this feels surreal to you. It seems so weird to me to talk about Dolly Parton in the past tense.
Well, she's here. You know, we're in RCA studio, and she recorded so many songs here.
Those songs included I Will Always Love You.
Oh, isn't that beautiful, though?
Yes. And Jolene.
She played this rhythm that nobody could ever play. Mm-hmm. She had to show the musicians in this studio how to get that groove herself.
The news of the music icon's death shocked the world. We know that the diagnosis is cancer, and the family has decided not to share what type of cancer mm-hmm. it was. Why have you all decided to keep that private?
Well, that was her business.
That's what, yeah.
And
she ask you all to do that?
No, but she didn't tell us that we could say it. Mm-hmm. So out of respect for her, I can talk about my love for her yeah. and describe who she is to me, but it's not my business to mm-hmm. tell her business.
Your sister Frida, when she said, everybody pray for Dolly, mm-hmm. that was the first time we went, whoa.
Yeah.
What is happening? Was Dolly upset about that?
I think Dolly got on to Frida about that. I don't know because
yeah.
I haven't asked Frida because it was very touchy about all that. So I didn't want to hurt Frida's feelings and I didn't want to mention it to Dolly. But I'm pretty sure Dolly said, you're going to, you know, pipe it down.
Because that was the first time people thought, oh. Mm-hmm.
She knew that Frida was just upset
yes.
and hurt. But she thought, don't be telling my situation. You
yeah.
know, Frida, don't be spilling my business.
Yeah. But even Frida said, you know, listen, I'm sorry. It's just that I know prayers work.
Yeah.
And so I was really just asking for your prayers.
That's the last thing Dolly asked me for was prayer.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then that's what she said about Frida.
Yeah. A lot of people were fascinated with the relationship she had with Carl. What were they like together? What was he like? What were they like as a couple?
He adored her. He was fascinated with her. He thought she was funny, like Tinkerbell, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was quiet and shy. And
he was quiet and shy, really?
Yes, very much so. I was there with the night that she won the first award in 1967, and he went to the BMI Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back home with them that night, and he was yanking off his tie and everything because he couldn't stand all that crowd. And he mm-hmm. said, now, listen, I'm not doing this ever again. And
she went one time.
Yeah, he said, I'm never doing this again. But they had a sweet romance.
Yeah. Was he very encouraging of her?
No, he didn't care about that at all. He would have rather her be at the house with her hair up in a ponytail
uh-huh.
and barefooted, cooking in the kitchen and just, you know, messing around the house.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he would have preferred.
But he was supportive of her career, wasn't he?
He was proud of her.
Oh, okay.
And he loved her enough to let her be what she was.
Yes.
That's
yes.
how I see it.
Carl Dean died last year. Some people say, well, you know, she really died of a broken heart. Do you think she died of a broken heart?
I think she was very sad, but I don't think I don't think that's why she got sick. I yeah. think she worked too hard and didn't maybe take as good a care of herself as she should have.
She said that. At one point she said, you know, I spent a lot of time caring for Carl that maybe I neglected myself. You think that was true?
To a point.
To a point, yeah.
I know their relationship was very unique and very deep and loyal. And I think it broke her heart to see him mm-hmm. in the shape he, you mm-hmm. know, got to mm-hmm. before he passed away. But I don't think that's what made her sick. Mm-hmm. I think My sister worked so hard for so long and just kept going, you know, even to the last conversation I had with her, she was working. That was her passion.
Death often doesn't make sense when you lose a loved one. It doesn't make sense. And I think sometimes we need closure to understand it. She had released a statement saying, I'm planning some more special performances. They're clipping my wings a little bit, but I'm going to be okay. That's why we're all struggling, Stella.
No, you heard her say.
Yes.
She said, I want y'all to know my wings are getting a little tired.
Yeah. That's why I'm here, because my little butterfly wings are getting kind of tired.
I knew then, it's like, I shouldn't even be sitting out here. I'm dying right now.
Yeah.
But I'm going to give it everything I've got to the last minute.
What do you miss most about her as we sit here today?
Her optimism is what I'm going to miss the most, because she was the most optimistic person I ever knew. And I'm going to miss that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't miss her struggling in pain.
Can you say if she was at peace? Was she at peace?
I know she was at peace.
Why do you know that?
Because I could always tell by looking at her face, even if I hadn't seen her in months on camera, I could tell if she was hurt, angry, happy or sad, or felt bad. I could see it on her. She's my sister, you know. We were very close as a family. She knew where she was going. She wasn't going anywhere bad. She was going to be with Mom and Daddy.
She was prepared.
Yeah, she was definitely prepared.
You could say Dolly was always prepared. I don't know anybody who saw her without her makeup. I'm sure you did, but I don't know anybody.
I did not.
What?
She would come and spend the night
Wait, Stella. You never saw your sister without her makeup?
Nope.
Stop it.
No.
Whoa.
Not after we got to, you know, not after she got to be Dolly Parton, no.
Really?
No, she would sleep in her makeup when she'd come spend the night with me. Yeah.
Really?
I would, and I'd sleep with a pillow over my head, you know.
Did you ever say, this is so interesting to me, did you ever say, could I see you without your makeup?
Oh, I knew what she looked like. She looked like me without her makeup. So I knew what she looked like without it.
Dolly's iconic look was a centerpiece of tributes around the world. But while the public saw an outpouring of support, Stella says, surprisingly, she didn't hear from one community.
I will say that I haven't heard from anybody in Nashville since my sister passed away.
What do you mean, Stella?
I haven't had one condolence from anybody that I know, entertainers that I know. Nobody.
Not one?
Not one.
How do you explain? I'm stunned to hear that.
Because I'm assuming it might be because of my political, you know, activism on social media. I don't know.
Dolly, however, famously kept her political opinions private. We never knew any of her political views.
She had them.
I'm sure she did. What were they, Stella? Go ahead.
I'm not telling.
But she had them, but she never shared them.
She would never have offended anybody.
She had an opinion about things, but she never shared any of that.
She never would have done that. Uh-huh. She was smarter than me. You know, I tell everything. You know, I like everybody knowing what I think about it. But, not
but
her.
Why do you think she decided that she would keep that to her? Even though
she's
was very
a good
opinionated.
Businesswoman.
Oh, okay.
She's a good businesswoman.
Uh-huh. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
Can I ask you, did Dolly share your view, Stella?
I will not talk about that. You think you're so clever, don't you, Gail?
Back through the years, I go wandering once again.
Dolly said she wanted to be remembered as a good-hearted person who did everything she could with everything she had. How do you want us to remember her?
I want you to remember her as a very sweet, kind, loving, brilliant.
Brilliant.
And so talented. Her creativity had no bounds, you know, and she could dream bigger than anybody. And I want young people, young girls and boys that may think they have no opportunity to dream. Coming from our situation, she gave us permission to dream that way.
In my coat of many colors, my mama made for me.
Thank you.
we had to end that with the song Coat of Many Colors because it was both Stella and Dolly's favorite song, Coat of Many Colors, because it was about their upbringing. But I just fell in love with Stella. After we were done with that interview, I wanted to go over to her house to just sit and talk and eat. But special shout out to the team. They were editing this piece till right before we went on the air to Gisella and Alicia.
Turned out
everybody
great.
Who shot it, and JT, the editor.
Gail, that interview is one more example of why there is nobody better than you at these kinds of sensitive interviews, but also
sure.
a lot of information we did not know.
Oh, I know. The thing, what she said about Carl Dean, I think people may be surprised, but I don't want people to misunderstand what she was saying. He came from a different generation,
but
he was still very supportive of her and very proud of her.
Yeah.
And men back then would prefer that you stay home and you're in the kitchen. So I didn't take that.
And doesn't always
mean. I
didn't
take it that way.
You didn't either, right?
I didn't take it that way.
I took it more he wanted his wife close, because understanding her being Dolly Parton outside, she was away majority of the time.
And by the way, she was a brilliant businesswoman and did some incredible things.
No doubt.
Yeah. Gail, that was really
But I was surprised that Nashville, though, hadn't reached out to her. That sort of stopped me in my tracks when she said that.
We should have had, like, a two camera on us, because we were all like, what?
That was
crazy.
My reaction.
Are we going to drop an extended interview of that on YouTube?
Yes, we have it, because it was a long interview.
Perfect.
It was a lot
of
good.
All right, coming up ahead, the cult favorite movie, Practical Magic, is back with a new sequel nearly 30 years later. Sandra Bullock tells Adriana Diaz why it was so meaningful to return to the franchise. We are back. In just a bit. We'll see you in a second. Stick around. When I'm
Matching outfits, extravagant birthdays, many nicknames, a few classic moves of a dog-obsessed parent. At Ollie, they're obsessed with how obsessed you are with your pup, which is why they obsess over giving your dog the best. Ollie's fresh, human-grade recipes are developed by real chefs and backed by vet nutritionists. The meals are perfectly portioned and come with a pup-tainer and scoop for easy storing and mess-free serving, delivering the best experience for you and your pup. And through the Ollie app, you can actually check in on your dog's health with real vets. By uploading a picture, their team can check your dog's weight, digestion, teeth, and coat. They'll then provide next steps on how to keep them thriving. And because they're just as obsessed as you are, there's zero judgment if you check in every day. You could say Ollie feeds the obsession. Go to ollie.com/firstbox and use code FIRSTBOX to get 70% off your welcome kit. Ollie, feed the obsession.
Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman hope to cast a spell on movie audiences, you could say, this weekend. You see what we did there? The Oscar-winning actors return as a pair of sisterly witches in Practical Magic 2. People are talking about this movie. Not only are they back, but these iconic Owens house was rebuilt for the sequel. And they even shot some of the film in England. Sounds like a good shoot to me. The movie comes nearly 30 years after the original became a cult classic. Now, a new leading man is joining them. His name? Lee Pace. He's fantastic. Adriana Diaz spoke to Bullock and Pace about making magic together.
Do you believe in witches?
Well, I just don't like the word.
Oh, you don't?
I don't. Oh, my God, it means such horrible things. Why can't we call them something else? These incredible forces.
I've waited such a long time for this.
She has.
The incredible forces are back after 28 years. Same magic, more midnight margaritas, and a new leading man, played by Lee Pace, who makes quite an entrance.
He's under a spell.
These two, you know, incredibly magnetic witches show up in my apartment.
Your bedroom while he's naked. Does not get better than that. I concur.
When was the last time you were touched?
Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman return as the Owen sisters, Sally and Jillian, who first bewitched fans in 1998's Practical Magic.
Woo! Hang on to your husbands, girls.
The family of witches lives with a curse.
You're the Owen sisters.
Yeah, everyone we love dies.
Taking a little bit of a turn here, you know the question that people ask, what Sex and the City character are you?
Oh.
Well, what Practical Magic character are you? Are you a Sally or are you a Jillian?
Oh, for sure, I'm a Sally. Who aspires to be a Jillian. I'm aspiring to be more Jilly-like. I'm Sally, right?
You're real Sally.
I know, I am. Organized, practical, prepared.
In the sequel, Sally tries to protect her daughters, played by Joey King and Maisie Williams, by hiding the truth about the family's mystical powers.
It's true. We're witches in curses room.
I will never trust you again.
The first movie is a love letter to sisterhood.
Yeah.
This second movie is also a love letter to motherhood. I saw so many parts of myself also in this, how you as a mother, maybe quiet parts of you for the sake of your family or try to protect your kids, maybe too much.
I'm always thinking about what genetic and, you know, lineage course correction I can do so that my kids don't carry the burden of my baggage or my mother's or my grandmother's baggage. But that's also what the story is about. Sally went a bit too far.
Magic becomes a metaphor for things that we all experience in life. The connection you feel with your family, with your kids, with your parents and stuff, there's nothing more magical than that, really.
In the Owens family, Sally and Jillian are now stepping into their roles as the matriarchs and learning to embrace loss.
My blood, your blood.
You deal with grief, but it's done so beautifully. It's really, it's more than just a celebration. It's just like there's a naturalness to the transition.
The first movie, there was a lightness to it, and this movie has a maturity to it that with maturity comes things like grief.
The theme is carried through the whole thing. It's the reason why Sally acts the way that she acts. She's like, I'm not going to experience that again. I am not going to let my children experience it. I am not going to let them have that pain, when in fact, that pain is an honor, I think. I think being able to grieve means you loved in a massive way.
And Bullock has said, art imitates life. She lost her love, Brian Randall, in 2023, after caring for him for years during his battle with ALS. This is her first film since his passing.
I read that you told the screenwriters to use as much of your personal story as they wanted.
Because it was going to show up whether I liked it or not.
How was it for you shooting this so soon after you lost your partner?
You know, it's funny. Like, I felt like I was... My process was like, you just want to do the right thing for the kids, so it's almost robotic. Not until we went to England did I feel truly, like, free. Not free of a grief, but it was such a happy time. Like, I loved going and seeing Lee. I loved seeing their crew. I loved the girls. I loved Nick. Like, every person that was there was someone whose heart I was just happy being around. So I'm just letting all the stages roll out as they come, you know, but it reminded me what a happy person I am, just by nature.
Finding the magic wherever there's love. For CBS Mornings, I'm Adriana Diaz.
So you can thank us for giving you a suggestion for what you can do this weekend.
Right.
We can recommend a movie for you. There you go.
It's good to see Sandra Bullock back on the big screen.
Yes. And the two of them together, too.
Yeah, two of them together. That. She's such a blockbuster draw.
I like that.
Yep. Like Gail said, Practical Magic 2 is in theaters today. Hey. So make sure you go see it. Give you something to do with the family.
Tomorrow marks 25 years since the September 11th attacks, and the man accused of masterminding them still hasn't faced a trial. The new documentary, Daughters of 9/11, from See It Now Studios, follows two women who lost their fathers when the Twin Towers fell and their quest to find justice. Elizabeth Miller's father, Douglas, was a firefighter who ran into the burning World Trade Center. And Jessica Trant's father, Daniel, was a Cantor Fitzgerald bond salesman who died on the 100th floor of the North Tower. Their journey leads them to retired FBI Special Agent Frank Pellegrino, who spent more than a decade of his life hunting for the mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Here is a preview of Daughters of 9/11.
9/11 isn't over. The 9/11 case is not over.
There is a man who is responsible sitting in Guantanamo Bay.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He admitted it, and still, not one single person has been tried and convicted for 9/11.
Another plane has just hit.
It's been 25 years of our lives without our dads.
My relationship with KSM starts from 1993 and continues till today.
If Frank Pellegrino had picked up Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, 9/11 probably never have happened.
The reason we still don't have one single verdict is because of the torture program.
It's not the way the FBI would have done it, and it's not the way I would have done it.
We find out the FBI is going to be able to interview KSM.
He spoke to me voluntarily, and he told us, just about everything about 9/11.
He was involved in planning, training operatives, and getting them the funding.
It's a disservice to us both, and it's a disservice to the American people that this is still ongoing.
Frank Pellegrino, Jessica Trant, and Elizabeth Miller join us. Thank you for being here. And first, let me just acknowledge the loss of your father and what so many other people are going through on this anniversary. And this is very, very powerful. Let me ask both of you, you now known each other and became friends through this. How are you feeling this week?
It's a lot. Yeah. It's a busy week. I think there's an overwhelming sense of love that we're being shown, but I'm also a little bit ready to retreat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How are you feeling?
You know, it's always strange with the anniversary coming up, but also I'm excited for these people, for the world to see this documentary, because I think it's time for people to know the truth.
Yeah, I am too. I've seen many documentaries. I have to say, I'm not just saying it because of Susan Zirinsky. See it now. It's one of the best I've seen. One of the fascinating things is the relationship between the two of you, because you have two different points of view about what should happen to KSM. Jess, you've made it clear in your words, he should rot in hell. Elizabeth, you've said, you know, I would prefer a life in prison. And it's interesting, the dynamic between the two, how you navigate those two different points of view. Elizabeth, for you specifically, you made a point of digging into the Arabic culture because you said, we know what happened. I wanted to know the why. What did you find out?
Yeah, I mean,
And why did you want to know the why? Because for some people, we don't care what the why is. Yeah.
I think for me, it's important to always understand why something happens, whether you agree with it or not. Just for me, having a basis of understanding, I think, helped me to personally cope and just understand the severity of, again, how did this end up being my life? But there's so much that goes into it with international, you know, politics, foreign policy, military, war. You never turn to violence.
Did you get an answer that was satisfactory to you?
I mean, there's always more answers that could be found. Yeah. And I think that's why this case in Guantanamo is so important, because there's more answers for us to find out.
Yeah, the why is very important. And as Gail mentioned, some people don't care about the why. They care about justice. And speaking of justice, Frank, as we saw in the preview, you mentioned that KSM confessed to you in an interview at Guantanamo Bay in 2007. But a military judge said that that confession will not be used because of the CIA using torture methods. What do you make of that decision?
I don't agree with the decision. I think, and I don't know if the ruling actually came out, but he was really more leaning on, I felt, he didn't think we separated from enough from what had happened before to our interview in Gitmo, that we didn't make it voluntary enough. We didn't prove it was voluntary, what we did, which I completely disagree with. We gave him every chance to step away, to not to talk to us, and gave him every opportunity to back off. And, you know, he wanted to talk, and he didn't talk for that long. And when he was ready to stop, he said, I'm done.
What was it like to sit down across from him after chasing him for so long?
Well, it was interesting. It was disappointing. It took so long to get there. Yeah. I was hoping to do it as soon as he was arrested. I think he was just as interested because he knew we were chasing him. So he was a little interested as well. But I knew I had a job to do. And you have to get past, when you're interviewing somebody like this, you have to get past the hate that you have or the anger that you have.
Right.
Because my job is not to be angry. My job is to convince him to talk to me.
But you were saying he had no remorse. He was very arrogant. And I was fascinated by you. I was very touched by you, Frank, because you said, in addition to the anger, that you feel such guilt today, that you still feel such guilt. Could you talk about why you feel guilt? Because you've dedicated your life to this. And girls, women, I want you to react to his thing about guilt, Jess, but go ahead, Frank.
Well, we identified KSM
Years ago.
We indicted him in 1996. And we were actively looking for him and doing things that were different, even for the FBI. We almost had him in Gutter in 95. We had another chance to probably narrow down his location, and it didn't work out. You know, all I can think of is, you know, I see people having to make the decision to, on the ledge of the 100th floor of the World Trade Center, that they felt that their best way out was to jump. And, you know, I had 5 years to find them and we didn't. Mm. So it's uncomfortable at times.
I see that. Yeah. He says he feels guilty, Jess. When you hear that, what do you think?
I don't think he should. I think he was the only one looking for him with his partner. It's a big world out there. And I think he was one of the only people that was screaming from the rooftops that who this guy was, and nobody was really listening to him. And he spent most of his career looking for him. Mm-hmm. People were focusing on other people. John O'Neill was going after Bin Laden. And even after 9/11 happened, you know, Frank was saying, this is my guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that I feel indebted to Frank, if anything. And I think it's been a privilege doing this documentary with him, because I think that he has dedicated even after 9/11 mm-hmm. to us families. So I think that he shouldn't feel an ounce of guilt.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say that, Jess, you said you lost your way for a moment because you said, I don't want to be one of the 9/11 people. Your mom talked very candidly about considering taking her life because she was so grief-stricken about losing your dad. What do you want people to understand that they don't understand about what your life has been like? Because for some people, guys, this is just a news story. Yeah. They don't really know the significance of what happened that day.
Well, we had to share losing our loved one with the world, our grief with the world. People forget that when the buildings go down, they're not watching buildings, they're watching our loved ones being murdered. At 19, your brain's still forming. I don't think I could wrap my brain around the fact of what my dad was going through. So I ran, and my grief turned into a responsibility when I was finally ready to deal with it. And that responsibility was going to Guantanamo, and it became my mission now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing your stories. Thank you, Frank.
Yes.
Thank you.
You can still see his face, Nora.
I can see it. Makes me emotional.
Me too.
But we thank you for all of your really hard work, Frank Pellegrino.
All of you.
Jessica and Elizabeth, thank you. You can watch Daughters of 9/11 by See It Now Studios tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on CBS and streaming on Paramount Plus.
Paramount Plus is your streaming home for the NFL on CBS every Sunday.
Touchdown!
With the most anticipated games and football's biggest stars.
Oh, what a catch!
Sign up for Paramount Plus today.
See you Sunday!